from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Picture this. A young man is standing on a narrow ledge, maybe 6 inches deep, his back flat against the granite face of a 2,000-foot cliff. He's climbed halfway up the mountain. He's all alone. Nobody's around him. No ropes. No gear. And he's smiling. The man in question is Alex Honhold, and what he does is called free soloing, climbing up sheer mountain walls without anything to rely upon other than his fingertips and toes, and a nervy brilliance that sets him apart from all other climbers. Alex Honhold, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Rock climber Alex Honnold is one of a kind. Just ask John Long, a legendary climber who was the first man to ascend Yosemite's El Capitan in a single day. On 60 Minutes, Long was asked what he thought was Alex Honnold's most remarkable achievement. He just shook his head and said that he's still alive. Honnold does what's called free soloing. That means climbing up sheer mountain walls without ropes or gear. He's the first man to free solo the northwest face of Half Dome. He's done the same up Sentinel, El Capitan. And now he's going to do the same thing on the second highest building in the world, the 1,600-foot Taipei 101 in Taiwan. And he'll do it on live television. Alex Honnold grew up in Sacramento, learned his craft on the climbing walls at a local gym. And how and why he got from there to way up there is what we're going to find out in this next hour of Forum. And Alex Honnold joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Pleasure to have you here. You just drove here and you spent yesterday doing what? Climbing up what in San Francisco?
Well, I was doing a shoot around San Francisco and, yeah, climbing little structures. It was pretty fun, actually.
You climbed, among other things, the Palace of Fine Arts, that ornate
tower. Yeah, not the actual dome because I didn't think I could get on top of the real dome, but the little section next to it. I don't even know what it is, really. It's like a long covered walkway, but it's really tall.
And what is that? Is that significantly different to climb a building like the tower you're going to climb in Taipei than climbing Half Dome? Is there a difference?
No, it's all the same principles. It's all the same movement. It's the same basic things. It's the same evaluation of risk and all that kind of stuff. Because, I start climbing it, I make sure the materials are solid. Because the concrete work on the Palace of Fine Arts was actually super well-maintained, like really nice, solid. I kept thinking of it as like, this is really good rock. And then I'm like, wait, I guess it's like concrete. But either way, I was like, this is really good.
So
it's super fun.
That's actually worth talking about for a moment. Because I think if anyone has seen the 60 Minutes piece on you or other things, you almost have the sense that this guy just sort of, all of a sudden, he's climbing up these walls. But there's a lot of thought, analysis, preparation that goes into this.
Yeah.
Describe what takes place when you're facing any new surface that you haven't experienced before, be that a skyscraper or a granite cliff. What is it that you have to assess?
Well, so rock quality is one of the main things. Just how solid things are, how secure the rock is. I don't know. I mean, there are tons of factors, though, just like judging, your own fitness and the weather and just, there are a lot of things that play into it. But it's very unscientific. It's just kind of how you feel about it and, how things. Yeah.
Do you, though, spend a fair amount of time before any big climb actually sort of plotting out a route and assessing?
I think that's something that a lot of people don't appreciate is that, they see a video of me soloing something and it just looks like I walk up to a cliff and climb it.
Right.
But in fact, they're actually like predetermined routes up the cliff and that people have climbed before and that I've climbed before for the most part. And so I already know the exact sequence that I'm going to climb up the mountain generally. I mean, occasionally you just go up and have an adventure and, quest up something new. But for the most part, you're climbing an established route that people have done before. And so you're sticking to like a specific way.
So it's not improvisational. I mean, this isn't like I'm feeling this, so
no,
I'll head this way.
Occasionally it can be that way. But for the most part, it's like more of a choreographed sequence. It's more like executing a gymnastic routine in a way, but on a much grander scale and like a much prettier place.
So describe what it is exactly before we get too far along here. For those who aren't familiar with even the term free soloing, I defined it basically as just you're climbing without ropes and gear. But give us a more full understanding of what's involved.
Well, I mean, that's basically it in a nutshell. That's kind of why Solong is such a cool thing, because you basically just walk up to a cliff with your climbing shoes and your chalk bag and you just climb up it. You know, in a way, though, that sounds a little too simple, because generally you rehearse it beforehand, you've climbed it with a rope, you've, you know, spent years practicing those techniques and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, the simplicity of Solong, you know, belies all the work that goes into it. But I mean, that's basically it. You walk up and you climb the cliff. It's totally awesome. It's like...
What do you feel like in those moments? I know you've been asked that question a billion times, but when I looked at the videos that are on your website and that are posted, by the way, on the forum website as well, if you want to get a sense of what Alex Hunnell does, describe that sense.
Which exactly? Of having finished a solo, or like while you're climbing? Or?
While you're climbing. And
because it's all very different things.
Okay. You know, well, take me through it.
Okay. Well, so beforehand, there's like a little bit of nervousness or whatever, excitement, you know, because there's like the unknown to it. We're only talking about like big cutting edge solos here, because like really easy stuff is just like a fun day out. It's like going jogging or something. But like the big ones that have been really important to me, you know, beforehand, there's a little bit of nervousness. There's a little bit of excitement. There's like, you know, I mean, I know that I can physically do it, but like, will I actually do it? You're like, oh, you know, this is going to be a big thing. And then while you're actually climbing it, for the most part, I should be sort of like shut off. You know, I should just be like executing the climbing and not thinking too much. And then on top, I mean, generally there's like a nice sense of satisfaction, whatever, for like having achieved a dream or, you know, whatever you want to call it. You know, sometimes though I finish solos and actually just been kind of like depressed or whatever. You get to the top and you're just kind of like, oh, because there have been a few where I feel like I like got away with something maybe, or it didn't go quite as clean as you wanted, or you're just like, oh, that wasn't quite what I was hoping for. Then you're just like, whoa, that was a bit too much, you know, because there have been a couple like that. I don't know. I mean, it ranges the whole spectrum.
So let's go through that a little bit in terms of sort of things going quiet and focus. In some ways, you don't want to rush, right? You don't want
You definitely don't want to rush. No. I mean, yeah, that's the ideal, is to be totally calm, focused, do everything perfectly. But I think that's true for all sports. You know, like when people are performing at their best in any sport, they should be, you know, like a quiet mind and like perfect execution.
People refer to the being in the zone, or that there's a book that was written about the state of flow, the author who was on this program not that long
who?
Ago, Daniel Kotler.
Steve Kotler?
Maybe it's Steve. Sorry.
I think it's Steve. Yeah.
Steve.
Yeah. Right. The Rise of Superman.
Right.
Yeah. I'm
right.
In that book. And,
right.
And I interviewed with him quite a bit for it. I just read that as well.
So is that what you have to achieve? And is that something that is you can achieve by way of saying, okay, I'm now going to be in the state of flow? Or is that something
Well, so it was a funny thing reading the book Rise of Superman, because, you know, I mean, I guess I've experienced the flow state quite a bit in my life, you know, doing these solos and all that. But then to read about all the neurochemistry and like what actually happens in your brain, in a way I was like, oh, I feel like I'm looking inside the sausage, you know, like I don't really want to know how it all works and like why it works. I just like being able to tap into like that special place where you like perform really well. And yeah, I don't know, like reading the book, I was like, oh, I could see how people would enjoy reading this, but I was like, I'd prefer just keep it a mystery and just go climbing. But, you know, but that's kind of the point of his book, though, is to take away some of that mystery, to like show people how to access that state a little bit.
And do you think it can be accessed, or is it something that is only available for you in those sort of moments? Can you draw upon that in other parts of your life?
I think you could draw upon it a bit. I mean, there's some basic things in there that I think anybody could touch on, you know, like finding that sweet spot between not too hard that you can't do it, but not too easy that it's trivial, you know, finding that like sweet spot of difficulty where you really have to focus and like it's a real challenge for you. I mean, I think that's like, for me, that's a big part of like being in flow. And I'm sure that's true for anybody in any subject, you know, you just have to find that right spot where like it's not so hard that you lose interest, but it's like just enough that it keeps you hooked, you know.
I would think it'd be pretty hard to lose interest. I mean, you're not going to get bored, right, in the middle of going up.
So soloing, if something was like way too hard, you would just get up to it and you'd be like, oh God, I'm going to die. You know, and you just snap out of the flow, whatever, because you'd be like, this is a disaster. Like, it's all coming apart. And then you'd basically either have to bail or you'd fall off. You know, you'd have to down climb or something.
But can you? I mean, there are times, I remember watching the 60 Minutes piece that, and John Long, the person I quoted in the introduction, says he's now at the point of no return.
But,
you can't
no, but
really
the reason they
down.
Got John Long as the color commentator is because he's kind of over the top and he like overstates it. And, you know, so it makes good like color commentary, but I mean, it's a bit over the, yeah, that's not really true. That route that I did for 60 Minutes, I'm pretty sure I could like hike to the summit and down climb the whole thing if I had to. I mean, it'd be a bummer. I wouldn't really want to, but I probably could.
So have you ever been in spots where you didn't think there was a way out, that you were in it no matter what, and there wasn't a way that you could back out of where you were?
Well, ironically, the times that I've had those experiences have all been on a rope, but like roped up with no gear. So like you're roped up, but there's just no protection. And so you're like way above your last piece of protection, and you're looking at taking, you know, like an 80 or 100 foot fall or something. And you're just like, oh, this is so terrible, you know. But the thing with soloing is that if you even start to feel super uncomfortable, it's like really easy for you just to reverse and down climb and go back to the ground. And so with soloing, I never really get into those situations where I'm like, this is horrible, I feel really uncomfortable. But with a rope, it's a little bit easier to sucker yourself into it, because you're like, I can push through this part that feels uncomfortable, because if I get gear higher, then it'll be fine. And you like keep pushing higher and higher, and pretty soon you're like, oh no, like now I've pushed way too far.
Well, and in your sport, I mean, the oh no has pretty big consequences. I mean, this is not, oh no, I'm not going to make this basket. Oh no, I'm not going to catch this, you know, touchdown
yeah, for
pass.
Sure.
This is oh no, oh no.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you've been asked this a billion times, but what about the oh no? What about the fear of death, the fear of consequence? Because if you make a mistake, it's a mistake.
Yeah,
that
in some ways, the bigger fear is like crippling injury, you know, like crushing your head or you know, being a paraplegic or something. You know, like in some ways falling off and dying, like falling off a 2,000 foot face and dying, I mean, that's horrible and I definitely don't want to die. But falling like 100 feet with a rope on and being like permanently crippled the rest of my life, I mean, that's probably a bigger fear. Because, I mean, that just seems, because then you're like, I don't know, that just seems hard for everybody.
So why, Alex? Why put yourself in that circumstance?
Well, I mean, I guess it's just a balance of risk, you know, because like I see that as a very small likelihood of happening. And, you know, I get a lot of value out of being in the mountains and doing these things. And obviously I do my best to minimize those chances. I don't know. I mean, you know, I think the balance is right. Like, I think it's an appropriate risk.
And how long do you think, is it like any professional sport that you can only do for a certain amount of time? I mean, I'm not going to be interviewing you 20 years from now, right?
I think you probably could be. Well, no, honestly, more than most sports, climbing has a lot of longevity. Because so much of it has to do with like adventuring in the outdoors and like going to new places and exploring and all those kinds of things. And it's not just about physical performance. So like, you know, Michael Jordan or somebody is like a 60-year-old, you know, I mean, he just can't physically perform the same. And like nobody cares if he's having a great adventure on the basketball court because he just like can't dunk like he used to. But climbing, I mean, it's just not like that. Like you can just keep going to far-flung places and doing cool expeditions and traveling and, you know, just, yeah, climbing is not just about the physical performance.
There's a scene in the video that was taken of you climbing up a mountain in Mexico, El Sendero Luminoso. And I'm going to see if I can get it up on my computer here. If it doesn't come up right away, we'll do something else. But so here we go, and I'm going to just scoot this ahead a little bit to where you are at about a certain point where you're approaching the end of the climb. And I just want you to look at this for me and tell me what it is that you're seeing at this particular moment. Oh, I'm not quite getting it. We'll get back to it. But it's a moment where you're climbing up and there's the camera comes in and you're just smiling. And it's like here, and the camera points down and you can see this. I sorry, listeners, I couldn't get it up on my computer screen, but you can look at this on our website at kqed.org. And you're just smiling. Do you remember that moment and what it is that
I did
you
see the video. I mean, I don't. It's funny because I've had many people ask me like, oh, what are you smiling about? And I'm like, well, because I'm happy, because I'm having a good time, which is why I'm up there. Though I think that it's important to keep in mind that the filming on solos like that is different than my actual solo, because like that particular route, I went and soloed it by myself and then we went back and filmed on it for the next several days to like make the video, because filming is like very different than actual like pure soloing. I mean, the point of soloing is to be by yourself, like without a camera crew, obviously. But, so when I'm back on something filming, a lot of the nervousness is gone because I've already soloed it and I already feel comfortable on it. And then I'm hanging there with my friends who are filming, you know, and they're all like close friends of mine. And so we're like swinging around and having a good time. And it's just fun, you know, I mean, we're playing on a cliff. Like, I mean, you know, there's a reason I do this full time, because I think it's awesome. But
Alex Honnold, our guest, Playing on a cliff, that is one way to think of it. Can you describe for us what else might give you that feeling? I mean, if you think about where you want to go with your career, because this is your career, is this the only thing that you can that can give you that playing on a cliff, that feeling? Or can you imagine yourself taking this in some other kind of career direction that would give you that same sense?
You mean just within climbing, or like could I see myself doing something outside of
climbing?
Yeah, being
a fighter pilot, or you know, I don't know what.
That would give you quite the feeling, being a fighter pilot. But no, I mean, it's funny that you ask, because actually 2 years ago, sort of the last year and a half, I've sort of started like a nonprofit for myself, just as a way to like give money back to environmental nonprofits. And just the last 3 weeks, I just finished my first sort of hands-on project, like through the foundation. I did a bike tour through the desert. You know, the like climbing desert towers in Utah, and then we wound up on the Navajo reservation in northern Arizona, and they did a bunch of like solar light installations and a bunch of work with the Navajo. And you know, I'm sort of like personally getting more psyched on those kinds of things, and I'm pretty psyched on the foundation and like the work that that we get to do. And I don't know, I'm like pretty psyched on clean tech stuff and like solar and wind and whatever. And I don't know. I mean, the thing is, it's so far outside of the world of climbing that for me, I'm just kind of dabbling into it. And like, but I find it very exciting in like the same way that.
Well, part of what interests me about what you've done with that work, and I read about what you were doing on the Navajo Reservation in particular in your foundation, is that you seem to have also taken a particular attitude, which interests me, about environmental work and about foundation work, that you're not going to let it get sort of bogged down, that you are going to bring a kind of attitude, in a way, to it, an athlete's attitude to it, that's different than a sort of more, I don't know, policy-driven, bureaucratic sort of environmental foundation approach.
I mean, I don't know what my attitude, because it's mine. You know, I don't know. To me, that just seems like the obvious way. But I mean, the approach that I've taken towards environmental type work is basically the same towards climbing. Like, even if something seems like some huge, crazy goal, you know, just to start towards it one little step at a time. And so, like the Navajo thing for me, I mean, it's a very small project. I mean, we're helping. All told, I mean, the project will run over the course of a year around the Monument Valley, and it'll probably help. You know, like the same group, Elephant Energy, just ran a similar program in Tuba City, which is also Navajo land, like last year, and it helped like a couple hundred families, and you know, got people like lights and batteries and all that. And you know, I mean, a couple hundred families isn't exactly changing the world, though. I mean, it is improving their lives for sure. But I'm like, well, it's just one of those things where if each year you just chip away at it, a couple hundred families here, a couple hundred there, they're setting up these programs, like enabling entrepreneurs like within the Navajo land to sell things, sell systems like at cost to other Navajo. And so, you know, that has the opportunity to grow in different ways. And I don't know, you know, it's like, it's definitely not saving the world, but it's like helping a bunch of families, you know, piece by piece. And I don't know. I mean, I've sort of thought that my climbing is the same way, where like, you know, you can't do this crazy big stuff, you know, right out of the gate. You have to just like go climbing all the time and just like work your way towards it.
But. Tell me about climbing the tower that's coming up, Taipei 101, in Taiwan. What is it that appeals to you about that? It's going to be broadcast, right, on live television.
Yeah.
Does that add to it, subtract from it?
Actually, the live broadcast thing doesn't affect it at all to me, because with any of these solos, I mean, if there's a cameraman hanging on the wall next to you filming, you know, it doesn't really matter if that's being broadcast immediately or broadcast a year later, or, you know, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't change my experience. Either way, I'm climbing something and there's somebody, one of my friends is hanging nearby with the camera. So I'm like, oh, sweet. It's all fun either way. If anything, the live broadcast is almost better, because it means that there's no like post-production shooting stuff. You know, as soon as I'm done, it's done, because it all just happened. I'm like, oh, sweet. That's the wrap. You know, I don't have to keep filming.
What do you, how do you respond to, some people have said it sort of becomes like a circus act then, you know, like the Nick Wallenda crossing
totally.
On the cable across the river and all that sort of stuff, that it's, that you're kind of you've become a circus act. How do you respond to that?
I mean, you know, it's fair enough. People can criticize if they want, but I mean, it's funny because last year I was in Dubai for something at the end of another expedition with National Geographic, and I was flying out of Dubai, and I went to the Burj Khalifa and just took like the tourist ride where you get to ride up to the observation deck at the top. It's like $20. You go up the elevator and you're like, what an amazing view. And then we also scouted the Burj actually for the skyscraper project. So the idea of somebody paying me to climb the outside of the Burj, you know, as opposed to me paying them to ride the elevator, I'm just kind of like, well, you know, it's like, I'd like to get to these positions anyway to like enjoy the view and like just to be up there and experience the exposure. You know, I'm like, why wouldn't I do that? You know, if somebody's like willing to pay me to do something that the thing is like, I would pay to climb Taipei 101, you know, it's like, but instead they're offering me and I'm like, sweet. You know, it's like a once in a lifetime experience. Like, why wouldn't I do that?
Yeah, I wouldn't tell the, like, the whole, I wouldn't tell the network.
Well, yeah, totally. Yeah. Don't tell the building. But, no, it's just one of those things. It's like a total life experience. I mean, as it is just from the scout trips where we went there to see if it was possible and check it all out. You know, I was standing on the very summit of Taipei 101 by myself on this little dome and, you know, with my phone, took a little panorama of the whole city. And I'm like, that's like the craziest view you could ever get at Taipei. Like, it was amazing. You know, like, it's a super cool experience.
You ever a friend?
Well, that's a bit of a change in direction. I mean, well, yeah, for sure. If I'm actually in real danger, for sure I feel the same fear that anybody else would. But, you know, I mean, being able to like keep that under control is kind of one of the big things in climbing, I guess.
Describe one of those moments and what happened and how you contended with it.
I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think of a good moment. Like, I mean, the thing is, for the most part, like I was saying earlier, that happens on a rope. You know, it happens when you're like climbing with a rope and you can't get good protection, or when you're trying to come back down something. In particular, the last 3 weeks that I spent on Desert Towers, the way back down was often the scariest because you have to rappel off these anchors, and some of them are like ancient. You know, like nobody's climbed a tower in 30 years. And for example, a couple days ago, a crazy windstorm with like rain coming down, and we're like trying to get down off this tower. And the anchor we got to was two hardware store nails just driven straight down into the mud because it's like a sandstone, like mud tower, basically. And I like pulled them both out with my fingers. You know, 30 years ago, somebody drove a nail into the mud. So obviously now you can just pull it out. And I was like, so much for an anchor. You know, you're like, oh. And so, yeah, you feel a little bit of fear because you're like, how are we going to get down? You're like, this sucks. And it's all windy and you like can't even think because, yeah.
And then crazy. What do you do in that moment to sort of get to the place you need to be in order to work your way out of that situation?
I don't know. You just go to that place. I mean, you just have to. You can't just stand there in the wind screaming, oh, no, oh, no. You know, it's like you basically
well,
have
you
to
could.
Act. Well, you could, but then you'd like eventually freeze or something, you know? I mean, in that particular instance, my partner actually rappelled off of my body weight. I just like sat down on the ledge and my partner rappelled off of me. And then as he went down, he placed some protection in the rock, and then I like down climbed back past it, cleaned it as we went. Like,
so as someone
know, worked
who's,
out fine.
Who's never climbed, I would think that a rope would give you at least some sense of security, but it really does not.
You're, well, no, the, you rope, feel... the rope gives you a ton of security and allows you to do all kinds of things. The thing is, though, in a way, the rope allows you to do things that you would never do soloing. Hmm. Because like soloing on a mountain like that, that's all like soft sandstone, like mud almost, you would just climb up to a point, you'd be like, this rock is terrible, I'm not going to solo on this, because there's like a very real chance the holds will break and I'll just fall off unexpectedly. But with a rope, you're like, well, I have protection, so if I fall off, it's like no big deal. But then if you don't get enough protection, then you're like, oh, well, I'm looking at taking a 50-footer. But even then, you're like, well, that could be fine, because if it's 50 feet of clean air, then you're like, that's fine, you're not going to hurt yourself. But it's like 50 feet onto a ledge, then you're like, oh, it's not looking so good, you know? So, I mean, you're just constantly evaluating that risk.
Alex Honnold, our guest this hour on Forum. We'd love to hear from you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take your questions, emails, Facebook posts as well. Join us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. If you're a climber, what would you like to know from Alex about some of his past climbs? If you're interested in beginning to climb, what would you like to know about how you go about entering into this particular craft? We'd love to have you join our conversation at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website. More with Alex Honnold after this. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, rock climber Alex Honnold. He's been featured on 60 Minutes in the New York Times, Esquire magazine, many others. Amazing climber, does extraordinary things that most of us wouldn't ever dream of doing, or maybe we dream of doing, but we just like to keep it that way in our dreams. He actually does it. We were just talking during the break about I was up at the CN Tower in Toronto, which at one point was, I guess, the highest, tallest building in the world.
I think it qualifies as something different, though. It's like a spire or something. They have all these different lists for, but it's a very tall structure.
You're way up there.
Regardless, yeah.
And there's a glass floor and the observation desk. And I was with a good friend of mine, and she took a picture of me standing on that glass floor, and I looked like I'm going to die. You did that as a kid, and your reaction was, this is so cool.
Yeah, I thought it was awesome. But those are the things I've always loved, just going up high on things. And I love the view. I love the exposure. I don't know. I just think that's really cool.
Let's take some calls. Lots of people want to get in and talk to you. Dean in your hometown of Sacramento is calling us. Dean, go ahead.
Yes, I just want to know what your parents think of your chosen profession.
Well, you wouldn't be the first to ask. But actually, my family's always been super supportive. I have been climbing all the time since I was like a 10-year-old. So they basically just trust me to make good decisions and look after myself. And in a way, my mom didn't really know the type of climbing I was doing until I was already like on the cover of magazines and things like that, and like in films. And then she's like, oh, wow, I guess he knows what he's doing. But yeah.
Can they actually watch you climb up the mountain? Because I could barely watch you on 60 Minutes.
No, me too. I mean, for the real soloing that I do, like, nobody really watches that. Most of my soloing is by myself. But though mom did actually come out to Yosemite a couple times. She watched me do the speed record on El Cap like 2 years ago. A couple other things. I mean, but those are roped up with a partner. But yeah, mom's come and watched me in the meadow a couple times from El Cap.
Dean, thanks for the call. David writes in, all these climbs could be done more safely with ropes. So why do them without ropes? It seems like you're maybe just doing something for the challenge or for the ego. Are you risking your life for that reason? Why do this?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Obviously the challenge is a big part of it. I mean, there's a certain mastery in soloing something. Because, I mean, for the most part, I have climbed them before with the rope. And so, you know, to go back and climb them without a rope is sort of a test to, like, see if I can climb them well enough, you know, or, like, to be that solid on them. But then there is an actual practical side to it, that climbing by yourself without a partner and without a rope is much faster and much simpler. And a lot of these things that I can solo in like an hour and a half, you know, take like a whole day with a partner. And so, it's nice for link-ups and enchainments when you climb multiple peaks in one day. To be able to solo them, I mean, you can climb one and then you hike down and then you climb another and you hike down and you climb another. And things like that would take you like 24 hours to do with a rope.
But it also sounds like you would challenge David's basic premise, which is that climbing with a rope is necessarily safer. It doesn't sound like for you that's really the case.
No. Obviously, on the things that I'm soloing, climbing with a rope is absolutely safe. There have been many circumstances where, you know, climbing with a rope isn't necessarily that safe. But he's talking about, like, the routes that I've soloed. And in that case, no, he's right. I mean, you know, having a rope on obviously would make it safer. But it would also make it slower, and it would fundamentally change the experience.
How central to that experience for you is the solo part of free soloing, the solitariness of it?
It definitely adds a lot to the experience. I mean, just, like, I mean, there's something super powerful about being, like, a tiny little dot on the middle of a gigantic wall of granite. Like, particularly Half Dome comes to mind because it's, like, a 2,000-foot face, but it's also quite broad. And so when you're up in the middle of the wall, you're just like this tiny little dot in the middle of like this ocean of granite. And there's definitely something to that. I mean, you definitely feel like the power of nature around you. I mean, all this soloing, like, it makes you feel very small, if anything. Like, I've done a bunch of solo link-ups and stuff where you spend the whole day soloing routes by yourself. And if you ever get into any trouble or you start to get tired or anything starts to go wrong, I mean, you realize that there's like nobody cares, basically. You know, like, nature doesn't really care one way or another. Like, if you botch it, it's all on you. And you're just like, oh, I'm just a little dot moving through the world. Like, that's, I don't know. I think it's cool.
It's interesting, though, that it gives you that sense of the smallness of us all. And yet it's also an experience that depends absolutely on your power, on your self-reliance.
Yeah, I don't know about your power. Yeah, I don't know. It's complicated stuff.
Let's hear from Richard next in Rockland. Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I've always considered that of all the sports that one can do, that mountaineering is the most intense. It's you and life and death. And contrary to what a lot of people think, it's not an insane sport. If it was insane, then there'd be a lot more deaths. And there's a few here and there, but it's the sport that I regard the most as the most intense and probably, perhaps, maybe even the most personal. Any comments on that?
I like this question. You're actually particularly well-informed. Because, I mean, that is totally true that, you know, there aren't really that many accidents in climbing. It is a relatively safe sport, and it is very personal and intense, and, you know, you do get a lot of life lessons out of it, just like you in the mountains alone being, like, suffering away, you know, with wind or rain, and you're just like, oh, you know, like, really cleanses the soul a little bit. But, yeah, no, that's a good question. Actually, you know, the Hemingway quote, the only three sports are... like bullfighting, auto racing, and mountain climbing, and the rest are all just games. Something to that effect. I've always liked that quote.
Hemingway also, I think it's Hemingway who defined courage as grace under pressure. I mean, there's a little bit of that in what you're doing too, right?
Maybe a little bit, though. I don't know if I would use the word courage, but definitely trying to keep it together under pressure.
Back to our calls, and Michelle is next. Michelle, go ahead.
Michelle from San Francisco.
Yes, you're on.
And thank you. So my son just woke up, so I'll make this quick. But I just got into mountain climbing, which is awesome.
Michelle, we're going to have to call back, please, if you would, because we lost your connection. And her question looks like on the computer screen, Alex, here, if Michelle doesn't get back in, is when can you get into climbing? At what age? She has a 2-year-old son and wants to know,
yeah.
I guess, whether or not you can sort of start the...
I don't know.
Obviously not free soloing, but what could you do?
I don't know. I started climbing as a 10-year-old. Lots of kids now start much younger and also climb much, much harder than I do. So, I mean, there's probably something to that. If you start young and push yourself, like, you're going to... be a pretty good climber. But I mean, a lot of my friends though who are professional climbers, like, didn't start till they were in college or didn't start till they were in their 20s.
What do you think the appeal is? I was walking through the Stanford campus the other day, and there's a new big exercise facility on one side of campus, and what's most prominent in it, you can see through the window, is a climbing wall. That wouldn't have been true, I don't think, a dozen years ago.
Yeah,
certainly.
For sure.
So what's going on with that, do you think, that makes it so appealing to that particular younger demographic?
I just think because it's awesome, obviously, because I just love climbing, so I'm sure other people love climbing too. But I think it's also, just, you know, I mean, maybe it's a little trendy right now. It's also, like, bouldering in particular is a fun social way to work out. I mean, certainly more fun than going to the gym and just hammering out reps with weights. Because, you know,
not
bouldering.
Me,
really? You prefer just going to the gym and, like, lifting?
Well, yeah,
things?
Yeah. I'm the last guy who's
really?
Ever going to be climbing up.
I don't know.
Yeah.
To me, it seems so arbitrary to, like, lift a dumbbell over and over. Though I'm, you know, I'm sure a lot of people get a lot out of it. But, like, going to a climbing gym, at least you, like, get to the top of something. There's also a problem-solving component to it, like trying to figure out how to climb something, like sorting out the moves. And I don't know. There's a lot of satisfaction to it.
Adam in San Francisco has a question. Adam, go ahead.
Hey, Alex. I was wondering about sponsorship and how you negotiate those contracts. Are you encouraged to do more, increasingly more exciting or dangerous things, or are you going to lose out to Dean Potter if, you know, he overlaps you or see you wearing a lot of North Face? I'm just wondering how that is for you.
Yeah, so I'm lucky enough that all the companies that I'm sponsored by, I pretty much have been working with since, like, before I was known at all, and it's all the brands that I worked with that I used anyway. Like, you know, I'm sponsored by the North Face. They're kind of the biggest one because apparel is, like, the biggest thing in the outdoor world. But, like, my climbing shoe company, Sportiva, La Sportiva, it's, like, Italian shoes. But, like, I've been climbing in those shoes since I was, like, a 12-year-old. And they just fit my feet really well, and I really love them. And so all the companies I work with, you know, like, 5 or 6 outdoor companies are all the things that I, like using anyway.
But I think part of where Adam's going with this is does sponsorship tempt you?
The other half of the question.
Yeah, if you're going to get $1 million to go climb something.
Yeah, it's funny. People always think that like sponsors are like pressuring you to do radder things. The thing that I think they don't realize is that most of the people working at these companies are like, they work in sports marketing, you know, like they don't really know what cutting edge climbing necessarily is. So it's not like somebody sitting behind a desk in some office is like, you know what, I thought up this rad thing you should do. You know, I mean, they encourage me to, like, to stay motivated and stay fit and to climb all the time. You know, I mean, they want me to, like, be out climbing, but nobody puts any pressure for specific climbs. And in fact, I mean, I think most of my sponsors would be happier if I, like, hung up the towel on the hard soling stuff and just sort of rode it out, you know, because, yeah, I mean, it's probably worse for them if I wind up horribly maimed, you know.
I would say. Adam, thanks for the call. Hansen writes in, Alex, what's your exercise routine like? How do you physically and mentally prepare before a climb?
I mean, basically, I go climbing all the time. So there's no, I'm never really training for a specific climb. Like, okay, next month I'm going to climb such and such, and now I'm just going to train until then. I'm pretty much on climbing trips year round. And so I sort of structure my trips in a way that I'll have the right kind of fitness and the right times of year for things that I want to do. But
you don't do specific things to strengthen upper body or hands or
Very, very little. I do like opposition and core stuff when I'm motivated. So maybe like half the year I'll do like push-ups and core every day just sort of for maintenance, you know, to make sure I don't hurt anything. But yeah, that's sort of kind of what I was talking about earlier with climbing. It's not a strictly physical thing. You know, I mean, a lot of it just has to do with like going outdoors and climbing and, you know, being creative, having adventures, whatever.
Do you think that part of what makes you successful at this then, not only, you know, your strength and obviously your skill at doing this particular, the physical part of it, but it's also mental and emotional problem-solving abilities, that all of that is part of what makes you be able to do this?
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it. I mean, maybe even bigger. I mean, I've always said that the biggest part of it is the motivation, like loving climbing enough to go out every day, day in, day out. You know, like this bike tour we just did, for whatever reason, it was like epically windy the whole time and we got snowed on a bunch. And so like spending 3 weeks of biking in the desert, like dry, cold wind with snow, I mean, you have to like be pretty psyched on climbing to go out every day and be like, let's go bike another 40 miles, then climb two towers, you know, because it'd be so easy to be like, we're over it. Like,
James in Arcata has our next question. James.
Hi there. I just want to say much respect to what you do. My question is, if climbing 1,000-foot rock faces with no ropes doesn't scare you, what does? My fear is definitely height, so much respect.
Thanks, I appreciate it. I mean, I kind of said this earlier, but I mean, the things that scare me are like real danger. Like if I think I'm going to fall off a 1,000-foot cliff, then I feel fear the same as anybody else. But as long as I feel solid and I'm not worried about falling off, then it's fine. But and what he said about being afraid of heights, I often say this to people because people are always like, oh, I'm afraid of heights. And I think it's very few people are actually afraid of heights. I mean, pretty much everybody is afraid of danger. Like most people are afraid of falling off of heights. And so like just the other day, actually, my aunt was like, oh, I could never go climbing. I'm like really afraid of heights. And I'm like, well, are you afraid of being up high or are you afraid of falling off of up high? Because being afraid of falling off is totally fair and you should be afraid of that because that's true danger. And anyway, she came to the climbing gym with us and she was super fit. She climbed super well. She had a really good time because she felt safe being tied into the rope and everything. And so I was like, you're not actually afraid of heights. You're afraid of falling to your death, which is a very fair fear. You
know? It's similar to what and so let's go a bit deeper with this. Bill writes in, can you ask Alex whether the majority of free climbers like him have an abnormal lack of fear of heights or if instead they just have a natural fear of heights but view that fear as a buzz that's part of the attraction? I think I know what your answer is to the last part. But so – what about that? It's not so much really.
You should have
a healthy fear.
I don't think anyone should have a fear of heights. I think people should have a fear of falling or fear of dying or fear of being injured because that's like a legitimate danger that, you know, like that fear keeps you safe as it should.
And it's not the heights that give you a – you don't want the buzz. It's not about a – right?
I do really appreciate heights. I mean, I do love being up high, but it's more for the view. I love like – you know, being on top of things and seeing the—I mean, yesterday I got to scramble a bunch of things in the city and being on top of even like a 5 or 6-story building in the center of the city. I mean, you get an amazing view of everything all laid out around you. And I was like, what a nice way to see the city.
Tony writes in about that yesterday. I was lucky enough to get to spend the day with Alex yesterday. His climb on the Palace of Fine Arts was absolutely beautiful. The small crowd that gathered was almost reverent while watching. It was a truly special experience to
be
there. Jeremy writes, has Alex ever climbed with Fred Becky? And can he talk about the first generation of great American climbers?
I've never climbed with Fred Becky. I think he's 90 now. So he is actually, or maybe he's like 85, but Fred is really old. And he is still climbing, I think, a bit. And some of my friends have like guided him up some things and like helped him hike loads to the base of things. But I mean, that generation of climbers is like a little bit before my time, particularly because when I started climbing, I started in the gym. You know, I was just like some kid climbing in the gym.
Can you see yourself, you were talking about with your aunt and the climbing gym, can you imagine yourself doing that as part of your foundation work, maybe working with older people or people with disabilities and sort of giving them an experience in some way that would take them out of their particular situation and place them closer to what gives you so much joy?
I mean, I can't see doing that kind of work through, like, my foundation just because that's not, like, my particular passion. Though it is, like, very satisfying to see people do that. I mean, like, my mom actually started climbing as a 58-year-old, I think, like, four years ago or something. She just, like, asked to come to the gym with me. After 15 years of, like, not really knowing anything about my climbing, she was just like, I want to go to the climbing gym. And then she got super psyched on it and, like, met a great group of friends. And now she's, like, outside climbing with her friends all the time.
So if we see your mom free soloing somewhere,
we'll... I hope that my mother never solos because she has a lot of practicing to do, I think.
You know, but... Dan writes, I heard Alex remark about paralysis. As a climber who put up routes with Tobin Sorensen and John Bakar, both of whom are deceased, I'd like his thoughts on how things change when he might have kids. I'm someone who is paralyzed when I was run over in a truck accident.
What's his name again?
His name is Dan.
Huh. Because the two people he refers to are both like legends of climbing. They're people that were like big inspirations to me as a kid and stuff. And John Bakar actually died. He was like America's premier soloist for 20 years. And he actually died when he fell soloing. Though he'd had like a horrible car accident like a couple years before. And so like, you know, there were maybe other health issues that like went into him falling off, but basically he just fell off an easy route that should have been easy for him and then died from it.
But I think where Dan is going with this as someone who is, he says, I'm a quadriplegic and was paralyzed in an accident, not while climbing, in a car accident. But he's just wondering about how you assess that and whether or not you think you'll feel differently if you have a family when it's not your parents watching you, it's your kids watching you.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a heavy question. I mean, that's kind of one of my biggest fears is to be hurt like that. I don't know. I mean, as it is over the last 5-6 years, like my evaluation of risk has sort of changed as I've gotten older, whatever, matured. And I'm sure it will continue to do so. And so, like, if I had a family or something, maybe it would totally change. I don't know. I definitely see a point at some point in the future when I probably won't do the big cutting-edge soloing stuff just because I probably just won't have the passion for it.
You're 28? 28,
yeah.
28 now. So how is it different for you now as a 22-year-old when you first did that free solo, first person to free solo up the northwest face of Heather?
I mean, it's kind of sucks, but I'm just slightly more aware of my own mortality and stuff, I guess. You know what I mean? I mean, it's kind of cliche to be like, oh, young 20s, you think you're invincible, blah, blah, blah. And, I mean, it's just heavy because I've had a bunch of friends die climbing now. You hear about accidents like that. You're definitely just more aware of, you know, the terrible things that can happen and just how quickly and unexpectedly some things like that can happen. But, but despite that, for me, it's still worth it to go out and climb in the hills. You know, and I'm sure that's true for anybody that has any kind of risk in their life. Like, you just have to keep balancing it as best you can.
Jagadish in Sunnyvale is next. Go ahead, please.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just have a quick question. Do you plan differently when climbing up rather than climbing down?
That's a good question. No, I mean, basically the movement's the same and it feels about the same. The only difference is that when you're climbing up, you should be leading with your feet. Like, you generally propel yourself with your feet. But so when you're climbing back down, it's much harder to see your feet because your body blocks the view. And so you're a little bit more awkward. But it's basically the same thing.
Thanks. Thanks for the call, Jagadish. Stephen.
He's probably practicing his down climbing at the gym right now. <He's>
like, could be. If you're climbing on a wall right now, if you have your phone with you and it's safe to do, you can give us a call. Stephen in San Francisco is next. Stephen, go ahead.
Hi. Maximum respect to Alex. I think he's a tremendous athlete. I'm curious, when he's in training for this specific climb in the building in Taipei, I'm assuming that there's going to be some sort of rig on him for live television, and I'm wondering how he trains for that. Does he train with a simulated rig, or, you know, how does he adjust for that?
So do you have, like, a GoPro, one of those cameras on you?
No, for the most part, I never climb with anything on me. Yeah, I don't know what you mean by a rig, but I would just be climbing just myself with shoes and a chalk bag, and then other people will film it, you know. But, yeah, I mean, I probably won't even really be doing that much specific training for that. I'll just be climbing a lot and making sure that I feel fit.
But you will have you've scouted out that building. You kind of know your way up and all of that.
Yeah, actually, the biggest part of scouting the building is to make sure the materials are solid, to make sure that it feels secure.
But. Jeremy asks, what makes a climbing trip bad or disappointing?
I mean, the biggest thing is weather, I guess. I mean, it sucks to go on a climbing trip and then just have it rain for 3 weeks and just sit in your tent. And I've had a few trips like that where you just do a lot of heavy reading in your tent. But, you know, even that, though, I mean, it's nice to go on a little vacation where you read a lot. But
Anna in Los Gatos has our next call. Anna, go ahead.
Hey, Alex, I have two questions. First is, I've seen a little bit of what you've done through the Honnold Foundation. I think it's really cool installing solar. And I wanted to know what the next step was, like if you had any idea of what you might be doing through the foundation next that was, you know, involving renewable energy.
I'm not sure. I mean, the foundation's like, you know, sort of a work in progress, like a bit of a side thing. I mean, I was just using it as a way to give money to other nonprofits. So, like, you know, stuff in Africa, grid alternatives here in the Bay. And then this project I just did on the Navajo lands is my first attempt at doing like a hands-on project. And I'll probably try to do another hands-on project like that next year, but I'm not sure what it will entail. But I mean, you know, climbing and traveling is still like my main focus. So like the stuff through the foundation is sort of like a on the side type of project right now, but I'm sure it'll probably become more as I get older.
Anna, thank you. Do you have is there a next great climb that you have in mind? I mean, beyond the Taipei building that we've been talking about some, is there something out there that you really want to do that you haven't yet?
I mean, I have a lot of rock goals that I keep, yeah, like real rock climbing goals that are in the back of my mind. But I mean,
such as?
Oh, I don't know. I don't normally talk too much about it. Because the thing with soloing things is that you just don't want any pressure, really, you know, because there are a lot of things that I would love to do someday, but whether or not I ever feel able or feel motivated enough, I mean, just who knows, you know, who knows if it'll ever come together. But I just would never want to talk about that kind of stuff and then feel some obligation to do it. Because even if I get all motivated, I want to be able to walk away from it. Like, you know, I'd love to be able to hike to the base and be like, this looks scary, and just walk away with like no hard feelings, you know, like no problem. I don't know.
Tambor writes, I'm a former technical climber, everything from bouldering to big walls. I always climbed with protection. To me, to climb without protection is absurd. It seems that your guest enjoys flirting with death far more than communing with nature.
I mean, you know, fair enough. He's not the first person to criticize like that. But, I mean, and a lot of my friends who are professional climbers, like, don't solo and don't do that because they just think that the balance of risk is wrong. I get enough out of it that I think it's worth it. And I think that the communing with nature thing, I mean, there is something very powerful about being by yourself in a crazy environment. And, you know, I mean, you definitely do get a different kind of appreciation. You know, everybody has their opinion, though.
Jeffrey in Napa. Go ahead with your call, Jeffrey.
Getting enough out of it, but I think it's worth it.
Jeffrey, turn off your radio and ask your question, please. Jeffrey, guess not. I'll read his question. Do you ever see yourself getting married and having a family, and how would that affect things? Jeffrey wanted to know.
Yeah, I could definitely see myself having a family. I mean, I would love to be like an old man someday, like roaming around the hills with my grandkids. You know, I mean, I've had a good family life my whole life, and, you know, I'd like to have the same in the future. And I'm sure that will probably change the way I evaluate risk and all that. But, you know, we'll see as I go.
Are you a guy who doesn't do a lot of fast forwarding, though? I mean, you don't really spend necessarily a lot of time thinking about what Alex Honnold is going to do at age 35 or 40 or a next career or any of that sort of stuff. Do you really focus on here and now as opposed to worrying about what that might bring?
Maybe. I mean, I focus, you know, I don't know, because I do plan out my year quite a bit with like, and then I'm going to go here and I'm going to climb this. And, you know, I do think a fair amount ahead. I just don't plan like 15 years ahead. Though, I mean, I guess I do a little bit because I would like to have kids someday and all that and have like a nice stable family life. I'd like to be slightly more sedentary someday, you know, instead of living in a van, like actually to have a home somewhere. And
do you still live in a van? And I remember in the 60 Minutes story that Laura Logan was quite impressed with your van.
I'm still, I mean, I use my mom's address in Sacramento as my permanent address. And then when I'm in the States, I'm mostly in my van. So, yeah.
Describe, as we come to the end of our program, just what you've learned from this and what... how the shape of what you do has shaped you, I guess.
Oh, I don't know. That's so heavy. You should have started at the beginning of the hour. We could have just talked for a whole hour about that. But
well, this is easy then, because you only have like, you know, 2 minutes to answer.
Yeah, okay. I don't know. I mean, you know, I think that you can take like an almost unlimited number of lessons out of being outdoors all the time. I was giving an interview yesterday and I gave this little anecdote that I got from Patagonia this season. but you know, I saw like on a wrapper or something, some little pearl of wisdom that was something to the effect that that pain is universal, but suffering is optional. Like that, that you always have pain in your life, but whether or not you choose to suffer from it, you know, that's like a personal choice. And at the time, it seemed particularly poignant because we were hiking in and out of the mountains all the time with like huge backpacks, like 6-hour hikes. Your whole body hurts, and it's like it's physically very uncomfortable. But you are in like one of the most beautiful places on earth, and you know there are glaciers and mountains all around you, and you're like, oh, what a great place to be. And you know, I mean, that's definitely a lesson that you can apply to like any part of your life. You know, like there will always be like discomfort or pain, but whether or not that, you know, causes you to suffer, I mean, that's kind of like all up to your own outlook, you know. And so I mean, I definitely thought about that quite a bit on this last bike tour, because like biking into a headwind for hours and hours, you're like, I feel very uncomfortable physically, but it is a beautiful day and it's a nice ride, and you know, I'm still a happy person.
And there's something about seeing your way through, I think, in those situations, if and achieving something that you didn't perhaps know you could do. There's great power in that.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Squeeze in one more quick last question from Jeff in Mountain View. Jeff, go ahead.
Oh, hey, Alex. Calling to pay my respects. And also one question. On one of these link-ups where you're going at, you know, three different walls in 24 hours or so, how many calories and how much water do you end up taking in during that whole thing?
Great last question. Thanks, Jeff.
I have no idea. It's a very unscientific approach, but I basically eat as much as I can and try to feel full the whole time. You know, I think that that climbing actually, though, is maybe less intense like that than a lot of other sports, unlike like road biking or something where you're just pounding out like an engine nonstop. I mean, climbing, there is a lot of like strolling through nature and appreciating things. I mean, you're not, you know, your body isn't burning that much, I don't think. But.
Alex Honnold, great fun, great pleasure to talk to you. Best of luck.
Yeah, cool. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being here.
It's been
fun. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi, with online assistance from David Marks. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Dan Zoll is our editor, and Danny Bringer is our engineer. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.